This hearing in the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. Today is Tuesday, March 10th, and the time is 3:30 p.m. We are in Butrovich Room 205. With me today are Senator Myers, Senator Giesel, myself, Chair Dunbar. We are going to have Senator Klayman on the phone at some point. He is currently presenting in another committee, and I believe that Senator Tobin as well has another bill presentation, so they'll be along shortly. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I would like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Chloe Miller from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We have four items on a very full agenda today. First, a presentation from Planned Parenthood, Kachemak Bay's Family Planning Clinic, and Dr. Ingrid Johnson, who are here to discuss the state of sexual and reproductive health in Alaska, including the importance of this access in preventing and responding to gender-based violence. Next, we will have two bills back up before the committee, SB 193 on naturopaths and SB 206, school suicide policies, firearm storage. Finally, we'll have an initial hearing for SB 272, health information exchange. So we will start today with our presentation. We have present Mr. Morgan Lim, the Alaska State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates, if you come forward. Ms. Lisa Humes-Schultz, VP of Policy and Strategy, Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. We also have Dr. Ingrid Johnson and Ms. Claudia Haynes. We have another presentation, I believe, after this one. We'll sort of present in shifts. So if you want to put yourselves on the record, I'll note for the record that Senator Klayman is now online, has joined us. So if you please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar. For the record, my name is Morgan Lim. I'm the Alaska State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. And today I'm joined by...
I'm Lisa Humes-Schultz. I'm the Vice President of Policy and Strategy at Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. Thanks for having us.
Today I'll be walking you through the state of sexual and reproductive health access, healthcare access in Alaska, the services that Planned Parenthood provides, and then later I'll share some of the federal attacks that we're facing and potential policy solutions at the state level. First of all, Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates is an ancillary organization to Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest, Hawaii, Alaska, Indiana, and Kentucky. PPAA advocates for policies that ensure that PPGNHAIK has operational stability and its patients have access to the full range of sexual and reproductive health care services, including abortion care. A snapshot of sexual and reproductive health outcomes in Alaska. Alaska is currently experiencing a public health crisis. We are the nation's highest rate of gonorrhea, the third highest rate of chlamydia, and the 11th highest rate of syphilis in the nation. Alaska's long struggled with rates of sexual assault and child sexual abuse. Those items Dr. Johnson will expound upon further, but Alaska's child sexual assault rate is estimated to be the highest in the country, with 1 in 7 people in Alaska having experienced child sexual abuse. Abortion care is protected under the Alaska state constitution. However, access is limited. There are currently only two clinics that publicly provide abortion care in the state, and those are Planned Parenthood's clinics in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. Additionally, there is no statewide mandate for comprehensive sex education. Only about half of schools in Alaska require sex ed content related to HIV, STDs, and pregnancy, and fewer than a third of schools in Alaska teach how to properly use a condom. And this lack of sexual health education is undoubtedly part of the reason why we have particularly high rates of sexually transmitted infections in the state. Nearly 50% of boroughs in Alaska are considered maternal health deserts, where people receive inadequate access to prenatal care, and Alaska has a particularly high rate of maternal mortality and infant mortality. Access to comprehensive sexual and reproductive health care helps address those. For example, access to contraceptive care and counseling allows people to space out their pregnancies and lowers the risk of poor birth outcomes, which includes low preterm birth weight and neonatal morbidity. Here's a snapshot of Planned Parenthood's health
service. Mr. Lim, if I could pause for just a second. I just want to say to my colleagues, if you have any questions, please let me know. I have not actually seen on my screen here that we have Senator Klayman, although I know he is online.
They don't show.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll say, Senator Klayman, if you have any questions, please.
Mr. Chair, I am online, and I will text if I have questions.
Excellent. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. Yes, please continue, Mr. Lim.
Great. Thank you. Again, Morgan Lim for the record. Again, Planned Parenthood is the only public abortion care provider in the state with clinics in Fairbanks and Anchorage. In 2025, Planned Parenthood Health Centers served 4,534 patients. 45% of those patients identify as Black, Indigenous, or people of color, and 32% live below the federal poverty level. So Planned Parenthood plays a critical role as a healthcare provider for communities that disproportionately experience negative health outcomes. Additionally, Planned Parenthood has conducted 2,264 STI tests, 1,462 HIV tests, and 4,397 family planning visits. And testing and treatment, again, critical to addressing the STI and sexual and reproductive health crisis that we're facing in Alaska. This is just a snapshot of the issues that the state is experiencing. I'm going to turn the presentation over to Dr. Johnson and Claudia Haynes at this point.
Thank you. If you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Ingrid Johnson. Would you like us both to, or would you prefer that we do that separately?
Why don't you both do it now? It'd be great.
Okay. My name is Claudia Haynes. I'm the CEO at Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic in Homer.
Wonderful.
So again, Ingrid Johnson, thank you to the chair and the committee for having me here. I am an associate professor of justice at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. When the last time you saw me, I was probably still at Anchorage, but I have since moved north. I'm continuing to do my work on gender-based violence and continuing to provide my expertise when asked on this topic. So I don't have slides, but I do have a handout that you all should have received in advance. So I'll be walking through the research findings not only on gender-based violence in Alaska, but also the research that connects the need for reproductive and sexual health care for victims of gender-based violence. So I want to start with just talking about what gender-based violence is. Gender-based violence encompasses a wide variety of harmful behaviors that are disproportionately perpetrated by men against women. Both men and women can be victims of gender-based violence, things like intimate partner violence, sexual violence, and stalking. But largely, these types of crimes and harms are perpetrated by men against women, which is why we call them gender-based. Of particular importance, when we look to the Alaska Victimization Survey's most recent data from 2020 and look at different forms of gender-based violence, we see that 1 in 5 Alaskan women have experienced reproductive control in their lifetime. So this includes partners trying to get them pregnant when they didn't want to be, or trying to stop them from using birth control, or their partners refusing to use a condom when they wanted to use one. So again, 1 in 5.
Sorry, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does that number also include women whose partners are or have pressured or coerced them into getting an abortion when they didn't want one?
No, the AVS does not include a question about that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So we also know that 1 in 2 Alaskan women have had partners who control what they can do and where they can go in their lifetime. So this includes monitoring who they associate with, how they spend their money, where they can go and when, which is particularly important when we think about seeking healthcare or seeking contraception. birth control. We see that 2 in 5 Alaskan women have experienced attempted or completed forced and or alcohol drug-involved non-consensual sexual penetration. So that's a big mouthful that basically means sexual assault 1 or sexual assault 2 in Alaska statute. 1 in 3 women have experienced coerced sexual penetration in their lifetime. So this is others using lies, threats, persistent demands, and or their influence or authority to pressure them to have sex. So this is coerced sexual penetration that wouldn't amount to SA1 or SA2 in Alaska statute. And then the final bullet point in that section is not from the AVS. It's from Uniform Crime Report data because it's on homicides. But what we also see is that Alaska has the highest rate of women killed by men in the United States, with a rate that is more than twice the national average. So, again, these are not new statistics necessarily. We're all quite familiar with the problem of gender-based violence in Alaska, but these particular behaviors are important for this discussion. Moving into the second section of the handout, we know that gender-based violence has multiple reproductive and sexual health consequences. This includes physical injury, including vaginal tears and other internal injuries. That's about 2 in 5 female rape victims. 1 in 8 female rape victims contract a sexually transmitted disease as a result of their rape. 1 in 6 female rape and or sexual coercion victims get pregnant as a result. And then, of course, this should surprise no one, but pregnancy coercion and birth control sabotage are associated with an increased risk of unintended pregnancy. And finally, we know that traumatic experiences, for example, from abuse or assault, increase the likelihood of engaging in consensual but risky sexual behaviors like not using a condom or sleeping with multiple partners, which then increases the risk of contracting STDs and unintentional pregnancies. So before I talk about the importance of reproductive and sexual health care for victims of gender-based violence, I want to talk a little bit about healthcare access more broadly, because this is something that I study when I study victims of gender-based violence in this broader sense of whether they're seeking victim services or other healthcare services or whatever it is. When we think about healthcare access, it's not just about the service existing. There's multiple dimensions to accessibility. So there's, for one, the adequacy of supply of providers to meet those specific needs, but then there's also the relative proximity of providers to patients. So, of course, in Alaska, proximity is a really big issue. We know that a lot of people have to travel quite large distances to get care, and that that can create barriers to help seeking. There's also the ease and comfort of attaining care, the actual and perceived costs of care relative to patients' resources, and patient and provider attitudes of acceptance towards each other. So all of these factors go into the concept of healthcare access and whether healthcare is actually accessible for the people who need it. So moving on to page 2 of 2 in the handout. Is where we get into the research and the rationale for why reproductive and sexual health care access is so essential for both responding to but also preventing gender-based violence. So, of course, as a result of gender-based violence, victims need things like physical exams, STD testing and treatment, emergency contraception, testing for date rape drugs, and or abortion care, all within a trauma-informed care model that recognizes, acknowledges, and accommodates the harm experienced. So when we think about responding, we see that abusive partners sometimes attempt to forcibly impregnate their partners. Sorry, this is actually more in terms of, responding to try to prevent them from being trapped in the relationships. So we see that abusive partners sometimes attempt to forcibly impregnate their partners to keep them from leaving the relationship, which puts them at an increased risk of ongoing abuse. And we know that pregnancy increases women's risk of being a victim of homicide. Further related to responding to these incidents of gender-based violence, we know that positive experiences with knowledgeable healthcare providers increases their likelihood of formal help seeking. So that's things like calling the police. So if they are seen by a provider who, again, recognizes, acknowledges, and accommodates their harm experienced, that will increase the likelihood that our criminal legal system will potentially be able to respond to that incident if they then report report to the police. But what we also know is not all healthcare providers are viewed as fair or competent by gender-based violence survivors, which can create barriers to further help seeking. So not all providers are equal in the eyes of gender-based violence victim survivors. Finally, moving on to the data related to prevention, what we're seeing now post Dobbs is the opportunity for researchers to look at differences across states in their access to abortion care and how that's related to violence rates at the state level. And so what research is now finding is that laws that limit the capacity of abortion providers through standards that go beyond what is medically necessary are associated with increases in intimate partner homicide. We see that greater barriers to reproductive and sexual health care are associated with increased rates of non-intimate partner homicide. And we see that greater distances to abortion clinics from municipalities without those clinics increases rates of gender-based violence in those municipalities. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I have a question. So You mentioned that Alaska is the highest rate of women killed by men in America, and it's certainly something I've heard before, but do you have any sense of why that is? I mean, what is it that makes Alaska such a uniquely violent place in this way?
Oh, that is a very large question to ask in kind of a limited amount of time. I would say Alaska has high homicide rates in general. So that's part of the issue. And we also have high rates of violence against women. So when you combine those two things, it's we would see that. As far as why we have those things, we do have a disproportionate number of men to women, and men are often the perpetrators of violence. And so that is potentially part of the equation. I would be mostly conjecturing, which I'm kind of uncomfortable with. There aren't a lot of studies that have looked at why, even though it is the million-dollar question of why Alaska seems to have this persistent issue.
Thank you. Are there any other questions before we go to our next presenter? And I'm sure the doctor will still be here if we have to come back and we have further questions. I think our next one is from the Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic. If you could please put yourself on the record again and begin your presentation.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. And I believe congratulations are in order.
Thank you. I should also say we've been joined by Senator Tobin for the record. Thank you very much.
So, again, my name is Claudia Haynes. I'm the CEO at Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic in Homer, and I really appreciate taking time to talk about a very important topic. And so over the next several minutes, what I'm going to do is introduce you to KBFPC, which is our acronym, share some of the challenges that Alaskans living rurally have in accessing reproductive health care and a lot of health care in general. And then also highlight some of the ways that KBFPC is supporting a healthy Alaska. Okay, everything is working. Okay, so Morgan touched on this, but I want to clarify that reproductive health care reduces severe maternal health complications, prevents unplanned pregnancies, detects certain cancers earlier, and lowers STI or STD transmission, which, as Morgan pointed out, is an issue in Alaska. But access to reproductive health care is not widespread in Alaska, particularly in rural parts of the state. And so as one of only three dedicated reproductive health clinics in the entire state, KBFPC is a respected, nationally recognized cornerstone of community wellness, addressing significant health disparities in rural and remote communities from Kachemak Bay to Cooper Landing through community-driven, innovative strategies and safety net service provision. So we're a proud provider with the state of Alaska's Title 10 Family Planning Clinic program, and we've been part of that program since 2001. And so that means we incorporate rigorous clinical standards, espouse the tenets of respectful care, and collaborate with more than 20 regional health partners to broaden access to care. The Title 10 program is arguably the most regulated federal program in existence. So we get A pluses every time. But we're also, you know, we're also a standalone nonprofit organization that partners with the state on the Teen Unintended Pregnancy Prevention Program. And we really, I think one of the kind of fundamental parts of our program is that we have a health literacy approach to our work. So we combine medically accurate health information with low and no cost care so that Alaskans can take that information and make decisions about their bodies. So a little bit about our clients. So we provide voluntary and confidential reproductive health services for adults and teens. We like to say from adolescence to menopause. And so while our clients live on the Kenai Peninsula, they work around the state. So think of commercial fishing in Bristol Bay or Prince William Sound. And they also do an array of jobs up on the North Slope. The Kenai Peninsula is considered a bedroom community for the North Slope. So in 2025, we cared for Alaskans at almost 1,000 visits, right? We're not in Anchorage. We're not in Fairbanks. We're tucked down in Homer trying to support people who have less access to general health care and less access to specialists who know what sexual reproductive health care is and how to support that. But our clients are mostly women, and they're typically low income. And so, in fact, 80% of our clients qualify for discounted services on the sliding fee scale that is part of the Title X program. And almost 40% qualify for a full discount. Our clients are covered by Medicaid. Some are covered by private insurance. And about 30% in the past year are uninsured. But we expect that to change with the higher cost of health insurance and the changes to Medicaid. So while we specialize in preventative reproductive health care, we're actually an entry point to care for the state's health care system. And I say that because 66% of our clients do not have a primary care provider. And I'll just let that sit for a minute. So they're not going anywhere else to care, that the sexual and reproductive health piece about our services is bringing people into health care system, right? So think, for example, a woman comes into our clinic for birth control counseling. She learns that she has hypertension and finds out it's time to start regular cervical cancer screening. So she schedules an annual wellness visit to stay on top of her health, right? That is a beautiful outcome where someone is improving their health, right? And so at each visit, linkages to other care, whether that's medical or social services, is an integral part of that visit, whether it's at our clinic or at one of the many partners in our community. And that, again, supports this idea of healthy Alaskans. So I just want to talk a little bit about our services. You know, Dr. Johnson talked about the importance of trauma-informed care, and that means that when people come into our clinic, we are meeting them where they are, what their needs are. We really focus on preventative care, early disease detection, family planning, preconception, and infertility consultation, and, of course, maternal health. So I mentioned annual wellness visits with breast and cervical cancer screening, hypertension prevention, contraception, and a lot of STI rapid point of care antibody tests for syphilis, HIV, hepatitis C, chlamydia, and gonorrhea, which helps clients get needed treatment quickly and prevents community spread, right? So we're this piece of the public health system and caring for individuals at the same time. We also offer pregnancy testing and verification, and I'll add that we provide factual non-directive options counseling that includes referrals for prenatal care, adoption, foster care, and abortion care, although we do not provide abortion care at the clinic. And then we provide menopause support, an important piece for those of us who have grown up with the clinic and it's over 40 years. So now onto challenges. I think we've been talking a lot as the state about rural health care challenges with the RHTP program, and so some of these won't be surprises to you. But our mission is really to provide broad access to reproductive health care. Why is that important? Because Alaskans across the peninsula and really in rural parts of the state all over really have a lot of challenges that dictate how they get health care in general and in particular reproductive health care. So on the screen, you'll see there's limited public transportation, even in a place like the Kenai Peninsula. It's hard to get from one community to the other, whether that's coming to Homer or from Nikiski to Kenai. childcare is expensive and limited, so parents and guardians are making decisions about the distance and cost of healthcare for themselves. They may prioritize their kids, but they're not getting that healthcare they need. Healthcare in Alaska is the highest in the U.S. And then, like the Kenai Peninsula and elsewhere, a lot of Alaskans are uninsured or what I call underinsured. So they have high deductibles and they just have high fees. And so they don't really, they're not really covered for what they need. And then honestly, healthcare systems are very complex and a lot of people have trouble navigating them. There's not always a person that says, hey, come in and this is how you make an appointment. This is what the next steps are. And then Dr. Johnson mentioned past trauma and how that dictates how you might get healthcare, who you choose to get healthcare, and what healthcare you choose not to get. We have a lot of different kind of this cultural diversity within Alaska, and so that sometimes impacts access to reproductive healthcare. And then lastly, you know, we have a limited number of providers who are specialists in reproductive health care. So do they know how to insert an IUD? Can they do a colposcopy? Can they prescribe PrEP or PEP for HIV prevention? And so some of this is scope of practice. Some of this is just kind of retaining and recruiting providers, medical providers for rural areas, right?
We have a question. Yes, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with the lack of providers. You mentioned RHTP. One of the things that we're discussing with RHTP is a bunch of compact legislation. A couple of those might impact you. We've got the doctor's compact and the nurse's compact. Do you think either of those would help your clinic or the situation in general?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about the RHTP application, the state's application, is that it talks about this investment in homegrown licensed providers. And our clinic, in its 40 years, has seen many staff members go on to particularly nursing. And so I think the retention piece for providers, whether that's physicians, certified midwives, advanced practice nurse practitioners, is really important because it's expensive to live in rural communities. But then also, you know, I have an RN who's interested in going back to school to become a nurse practitioner, and those kind of investments will help make that possible while she continues to work at our clinic or at other clinics in rural Alaska. So that investment is really important and will keep this care accessible.
Go ahead, Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you. But do you think either of those compacts would help you out, make Alaska a more attractive place to be a doctor or nurse, or potentially draw some people up that might be working elsewhere or something like that?
Potentially, you know, because we're low volume, I would think what would be appealing is for a provider to maybe attach themselves to a bigger facility and come work for us part time. I think that our state has a lot of appealing qualities, and the fact that we have dedicated reproductive health clinics will certainly appeal to some. So I think anything that recruits and supports retention will benefit us, even on this small scale.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Myers.
Thank you for your question.
Please continue.
Okay. So how do we deal with all these challenges to care? So in late 2022, we teamed up with some regional partners and said there are a lot of people on the peninsula that do not have access to reproductive health care. And how do we get creative? How do we look around the state and see all these options for delivering care that is very minimalist resource-wide? Because we couldn't open another brick-and-mortar clinic. We just really needed to kind of stretch what we had a little bit thinner. And so we came up with the KBFPC pop-up clinics. And so what we do is at least twice a month, you can see our nurse and also one of our providers head out with one of our partners and provide different services depending on the physical location. So when we go to Kenai Public Health, we can actually provide all the services that we provide at our Homer clinic. When we go out with the Nenelchik Traditional Council with their mobile mat unit, we're providing STI testing. So we're getting creative and providing care. And so really investing in these kind of creative options is really important for our state, and I think is really in the Alaska tradition. Some of the other things that we do, or we partner with the Providence Cancer Center, and their mobile mammogram unit actually pulls up in our parking lot, not to compete with any of the other mammogram providers, but to provide more options. And so we're actually seeing kind of the number of mammograms starting to tick up in the region, which is great because the peninsula, the Gulf Coast region has one of the highest rates of breast cancer and one of the lowest rates of mammograms in the state. So this is what we like to see. And then we also do things like kind of a meetup for parents of teens to kind of facilitate how to talk to teens about their health, and then a connection with providers outside of the clinic setting where they can ask questions about topics like menopause. And kind of lastly, I want to talk about the challenges to providing reproductive health care in rural communities. And some of these have a little crossover, but certainly there's distances. When our pop-up clinic program team is headed out, they're driving 60, 70, 80 miles to provide care, maybe to a handful of people, right? That's really important, but logistically, it's challenging. Again, there's a lot of socio-cultural variety, and just navigating that and respecting traditions is really important. Infrastructure is sparse and dated, and we talked about limited licensed staff. Just the cost of everything in rural Alaska is very high, or much higher. And then, you know, limited public and foundation funding for reproductive health is an issue. And the last piece that I wanted to put on here is that really security resources in small communities do not adequately protect clinic staff against new safety risks, like the two shootings that we had at our clinic in November 2024. I almost forgot to put that on the slide, but I actually just got a notice about a parole hearing for the shooter. And we have not, since November 2024, we have not gone for more than a couple months without thinking about how we just barely missed a mass shooting in our community. And that shakes people. So we had to go out of state to the hospital, in home, or multiple places to get resources to improve our security. And none of the organizations in Homer were prepared for that. So that's really important. So I'll end by saying that KBFUC and our colleagues at Planned Parenthood really stand as this kind of critical lifeline for many Alaskans, right? Particularly in a state where access to reproductive health care, including for maternal health, is limited and expensive to deliver. So I can take questions now or later.
I do have a question. So you mentioned the RHTP. Mm-hmm. Are you planning to apply? Are you able to apply? Is there something that you could realistically do with those funds? There's a variety of restrictions, but are there things you could do with them?
Yes, I actually just submitted three LOIs on Sunday, and one of them we're very excited about. We are preparing to launch, assuming we can get funding for it, is a postpartum home visit program as part of this broader remote services piece, and that would connect new families with a doula and RN who would support them through the first 6 months postpartum, because we know that reduces maternal morbidity, all of those issues, and it really improves maternal outcomes. It certainly supports families who might be dealing with domestic violence and getting resources in the community. So we're really excited about that. Also some pieces around kind of really dated clinic renovations that would support all of the rapid tests we're now doing at the lab, which we used to send out. We have two ultrasounds that we're able to use for, you know, IUD insertion confirmation or pregnancy confirmation, you know, handicap accessibility improvements, things like that, telehealth spaces for providers. So, yes.
Wonderful. Thank you. We have a question from Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's lovely to see you again, Dr. Johnson. I am a big fan of your clinic. When I was on the Pride Foundation board, it was the joy that I had to always vote in support of your entity. And I kind of have a two-part question. The one is just the challenges that you are facing fundraising-wise. As you mentioned, that most of the folks who receive care from you are low income, 30% are uninsured. We anticipate that number to go up. What are some of the challenges that you see on the horizon coming from that that need to continue to get individual or even corporate donors to engage, but the challenges that you might face? And then the other one that I'm just curious, because you mentioned the three LOIs that you worked on, and I'm anticipating that you don't have a full-time grant writer, that you're not necessarily able to go after and just try to find dollars. And so what would be your request of lawmakers who might have the resources to help support the work that you do and the reasons that you have all explained why your work is so critical?
You know, as I mentioned, we've been part of the state's Title X program for a long time, part of the TUP program, and, you know, partnered with the state on those projects. And I want to emphasize the importance of really long-term commitment by the state for reproductive health. And reproductive health is very broad. But when you have less and less clinics really doing that work, it's thinking really big about how we can address that growing gap. So I think statewide support for that, you know, Morgan talked about sexual health education for teens, which is, we're really starting to see that lack of sexual health education in the kind of rampant disinformation, misinformation, lack of information, you know, particularly on social media that's happening, but that dictates if people are afraid to get care, where they can get care, you know, what is medically accurate care. So I think those are some of the things the state can do. We, you know, have hundreds of donors that support our work from Homer and the Kenai Peninsula and do as much as we can to maintain those relationships, because we know that those people understand that care is important, whether people can pay for it or not. And so having the state of the part as a partner really helps in terms of advocating for financial support with foundations, with bigger donors.
Very good. Well, thank you for your presentation. We have one last portion of this. If Mr. Lim would come back up, and Ms. Hume Schultz, I'll say we are running a little low on time. If you're able to get through these pretty quickly.
I'll go as quickly as possible.
And again, not, these are meaty topics, but we have just have a lot of other bills.
For the record, Morgan Lim, Alaska State Director for Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates. I am going to talk about some of the reductions in service that sexual and reproductive health care providers, particularly Planned Parenthood, have been facing due to recent federal executive and legislative action. The first is the reduction in Medicaid dollars due to H.R. 1. Medicaid recipients were barred from receiving services at Planned Parenthood. It's a reduction of about 1,200 patients and about $500,000 of annual revenue for Planned Parenthood. And I'll talk about the revenue portion in so far as like that portion represents real people who aren't able to receive family planning services at our clinics due to again, this legislative action. So in addition to the reduction in Medicaid dollars, we are also experiencing a reduction of about $1 million a year due to our inability to participate in the federal Title X program that Claudia specified. We're not able to participate in that program because we are a clinic that provides abortion care, which is constitutionally protected care in Alaska. Additionally, beyond some of the recent, I think, legislative financial impacts for folks trying to access abortion care in Alaska, the Hyde Amendment has prevented tribal health from providing abortion care. Tribal health serves large portions of our state. And so, you know, again, those are folks who can, who have to travel to Anchorage or Fairbanks to one of our clinics to access this constitutionally protected care. The VA has also recently banned coverage and consulting for all abortion care in Alaska, which is extremely disheartening for the 10% of Alaskan residents who are veterans. Alaska statute also prevents providers from offering abortion care to patients in-home through telehealth. And there's a statute that mandates only physicians provide abortion care despite other qualified advanced practice clinicians being qualified to provide that care. That is currently enjoined by a Superior Court decision that is being decided by the Supreme Court right now. The FDA is threatening to revoke access nationwide to mifepristone. They're threatening to repeal approval of that medication that's used in medication abortion. Additionally, we're seeing other attacks on sexual and reproductive health care, such as gender-affirming care. I have here that the federal administration is trying to ban gender-affirming care for youth in Medicaid, the VA, and hospitals. They've already banned it in the VA, actually, and they're attempting to revoke all Medicaid funds for hospitals that continue to offer gender-affirming care. So for hospitals in Alaska, that would be devastating. This has long-term effects on the sexual and reproductive health of folks in Alaska. Claudia talked about the difficulty of accessing sexual and reproductive health services for folks who are in rural Alaska and off the road system. Planned Parenthood has had to close 3 clinics in the past 10 years. Those clinics are in Sitka, Soldotna, and Juneau, with the most recent closure being in Juneau. That represents the loss of dedicated sexual and reproductive health clinics throughout all of Southeast Alaska. Now for folks trying to access abortion care specifically, the closest clinics that they can access are in Whitehorse in the Yukon, or they're traveling to Seattle or Anchorage. This is not just difficult for patients, but it's also expensive for the state. Investments in family planning are extremely cost-effective. For every $1 invested in family planning, the state saves $7 down the line. And so as we see a reduction in $1.5 million from the federal government in family planning services to Planned Parenthood, that's going to have a multiplying effect long-term that is going to have to be absorbed by other healthcare providers because of the other knock-on consequences. Planned Parenthood is committed to being a long-term safety net provider. As you heard, again, from Claudia Haynes and Dr. Johnson, we are committed to providing non-judgmental and inclusive care. We provide trauma-informed care for victims of sexual and gender-based violence. That is a cornerstone of us as an entity. And as folks who are searching for care in those situations look for what they need, they know that Planned Parenthood is a trusted provider. So they are coming to us. And it is unfortunate that because of the systemic disinvestment and federal attacks that abortion providers have been experiencing nationwide for a long time, we have had to close clinics in particularly our most rural areas. There is things that we can do at the state level. I know that Claudia talked about creating and investing into a robust family planning program here in the state. That is, you know, I think a recommendation that we can all get, that all of us presenters can get behind in both saving the state money long term, but also going a far way in addressing the sexual and reproductive health crisis that the state is facing. Again, first in gonorrhea, third in chlamydia, 11th in syphilis, and maternal health outcomes that are, frankly, in the ground. Other ways that the state could get involved and provide assistance to sexual and reproductive health care providers like Planned Parenthood, which offers care to roughly 1/8 of all Alaskans of reproductive age, is backfill the Medicaid funding that we are losing from the federal government. Around a dozen states nationwide are offering this to Planned Parenthood clinics. And then we also would like to thank the committee for recently introducing SB 276, which is a bill which would expand access to contraceptive care by requiring an insurer cover a 12-month disbursement of oral contraceptives at once. We look forward to the discussion in committee on that legislation, where we can talk more about how vital that is to the sexual and reproductive health future of the state. And with that,
Thank you, Mr. Lim. Are there any questions? Do you have any closing comments?
Yes. For the record, this is Lisa Hume Schultz, Vice President of Policy and Strategy. I just wanted to reinforce very quickly two things, and that I think you heard that Planned Parenthood has had to close 3 health centers over the last decade, and that's really because of chronic underinvestment. We've seen unprecedented attacks in the last year under this administration, but there have been significant underinvestment, as Claudia noted, in the safety net system for decades. The other thing I just wanted to bring us back to the patient impact. We're talking a lot of numbers up here. We're talking about closures. We're talking about funding. And we hear stories every day of patients who are not able to access the timely care they need. And just one example that really drives this home is we had a patient who had heard that Title X funding was no longer available at her local clinic, and she cut out her own implant. There is a contraceptive implant in her arm because she did not know she could come. And she came, and we took care of her, and we would have taken care of her, but she saw that Title X funding was no longer available, and so she did that. And so just want to bring us back to that's what we're talking about when we're talking about funding and services here. So, and thank you for taking all the time for to hear from everyone today.
Thank you. Any final questions? Thank you very much for your presentation today. We're going to take a brief break. We set up for the next presentation. Next up, we have Senate Bill 193, Naturopaths, for its third time in this committee. We have heard both invited and public testimony on this bill. An amendment deadline was set for this bill for Monday, March 9th at 12 p.m. My office received no amendments. Here to give brief remarks on the bill, we have Mr. Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Scott Kawasaki, also available for questions. Let me double check they're actually here. Yep, online. Oh, no, actually in the room, we have Glenn Saviors. Yep, in the back there. Deputy Director, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, available for questions. Mr. Hayes, if you'd like to put yourself on the record, and if you have any remarks on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of committee, my name is Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki. And we'd just like to thank the committee for all of your work and hearing the bill. And we're ready to... We're open for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions or further comments on this bill? Seeing none, Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 193, version 34, LS0952/alpha, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Legislative legal has authority to make necessary conforming changes.
Is there any... objection. Let's see, nothing from the phone. All right. Seeing none, SB 193 version A moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. back on the record. Next up, we have SB 206, School Suicide Policies, Firearm Storage, back before the committee again for the third time. We have heard both invited and public testimony on this bill. An amendment deadline was set for Monday, March 9th, 2026, 12 p.m. My office received no amendments. Here to give brief remarks on the bill, we have Mr. Louis Flora, staff to Senator Tobin. We also have Senator Tobin on the committee. And available for questions, we have Kelly Manning, the Deputy Director, Division of Innovation, Education Excellence, Department of Education Early Development. Are they in the – no, they're on the phone, I believe. Yes. Okay. So, Mr. Flora, do you have any closing remarks, or Senator Tobin? Okay. Are there further comments from the committee? Comments or questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 206, version 3-4, LS1233/N, from committee with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes. Legislative Legal has authority to make any necessary conforming changes.
Any objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 206 version N moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on the record, finally for today, we are holding an introductory hearing on SB 272, Health Information Exchange. SB 272 is sponsored by this committee. I'll have my committee aide, Ariel Harbison, come forward and introduce the bill, as well as walk through the sectional. Ms. Harbison?
For the record, my name is Ariel Harbison, staff to Senator Dunbar. Chair Dunbar and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee, before you today, we have Senate Bill 272, sponsored by this committee, which updates Alaska's current health information exchange law. A brief history for the committee. In 2009, the federal government enacted the Health Information Technology for
There we go. Apologies.
For the record, Ariel Harbison, staff to Senator Dunbar. I'm going to start back at the brief history for the committee. In 2009, the federal government enacted the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act, which mandated that each state adopt an electronic health records. In response, the 26th Alaska Legislature passed SB 133, which provided the framework for a statewide HIE, health information exchange, in Alaska. This bill before us, Senate Bill 272, looks to update and improve Alaska's HIE while continuing to uphold the strict policy and security standards required bylaw. A few of these changes include providing clarity in the division of responsibilities by the Department of Health and the designee that administers the HIE system. And it also adds a representative to the governing body representing behavioral health providers. At this time, I can go through the sectional analysis for the committee.
Yes, please do so. I'll note also for the record, we have online for questions Jason Ball, Chief Health Data Officer, Department of Health, and Carolyn Hyman, Outside Counsel for Health eConnect. And we are going to have invited testimony as well from Kendra Sticka from Health eConnect after this sectional. Go ahead, Ms. Harbison.
For the record, Ariel Harbison. Section 1 amends AS 18.23.300, subsection A, to refine the department's mandate for establishing and implementing the statewide health information exchange system. It emphasizes ensuring system interoperability and compliance with the state and federal protocols for data exchange. Section 2 repeals and enacts AS 18.23.300, subsection B, regarding the designation of a qualified entity to manage system tasks. Subsection B requires the commissioner to designate one or more qualified entities to perform specific tasks overseen by a body of health system stakeholders. Paragraph 1 tasks the designee with developing a statewide program to connect electronic health records to the exchange infrastructure. Subparagraphs A through F outline responsibilities including training, participant encouragement, workflow support, stakeholder planning, evaluation, and technical assistance. Paragraphs 2 through 6 require the designee to submit an annual budget, comply with non-discrimination and privacy laws, and provide cost-saving data to the department. Section 3 amends AS 18.23.300 subsection C to allow the department and its designee to seek both public and private funds and equipment. It also clarifies the department's authority to enter into contracts and adopt necessary regulations. Section 4 amends AS 18.23.300D regarding the designee's governance and composition. The designee may provide or may be a private, for-profit, or nonprofit entity under state contract.
Ms. Harbison, I'm going to pause you here. I see we still got a ways to go in this sectional. However, I think it might benefit us now to go to our invited testimony and sort of try to hear a little bit more in plain English what this actually means. I think we're hearing a lot of technical terms, and I'm not sure if – I certainly don't know exactly what some of these words mean in this context. So why don't we pause the sectional, and let's hear from invited testimony. Ms. Sticka, if you might come up and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Kendra Sticka, Executive Director of Healthy Connect Alaska. We are the nonprofit entity contracted with the Department of Health to administer the Health Information Exchange. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this, and thank you, Ariel, for the overview. Really, the sort of the plain English language, and then I'm happy to go through any sections of it. I appreciate last year I was able to be before this committee and really present on the Health Information Exchange, so I think you all are quite familiar. Alaska has really, I think, done a fantastic job in building the HIE into healthcare infrastructure, which has been excellent. And so really in this bill, as Ariel mentioned in her introduction, the original statute was written at a time when electronic medical records were in their infancy and health information exchanges were an idea more than a reality. And so the language in the current statute is somewhat confusing because we didn't know what it was going to be. So really one of the key pieces in some of the elements that Ariel was reading in terms of what the designee, it makes it very clear that the designee is, for example, Healthy Connect Alaska right now serves in that role, what the designee needs to do and who could be that designee, that it could be a nonprofit, it could be a for-profit, but it clearly articulates that there is a designee to administer, and then what the responsibilities of the Department of Health are. So it's clear that the Department of Health oversees appointing that designee, determining the designee, doing the contracting, and then the designee is really responsible for all of the elements of maintaining the security standards, having the appropriate infrastructure, abiding by the laws required for HIE and for data sharing. So a lot of the language is really to just clearly delineate who is responsible for what and what the HIE can do. So the language should not broadly expand what the HIE can do. It just gives clarity around that. There are a couple of pieces. Sorry, I can't tell if I'm going in and out. Let me know if you can't hear me. The addition of the statute has always designated who is on the board, the governing body, to ensure that it really represents Alaska healthcare. One thing that is a gap that I think has come over time is that there's no behavioral health representation explicitly. So that's one piece of this bill that would add a behavioral health representative, which I think is really critical as we think about whole person care and how that fits in. The other piece that's added is providing clarity around the language of the uses and allowable uses of the HIE so that it's not left to assumption. So really the HIE permitted uses are in line with HIPAA standards, but having clarity around that ensures that people who look at the statute really understand what's allowed, what's not allowed, so people can feel comfortable about how that data can and can't be used. So I think that's critical to outline it. And then the only other piece is that it would allow an individual Alaskan to say, please send my data from the HIE to this place of their choosing for the purpose of their choosing to help minimize them having to track records from so many different places. Again, that would be a strictly if they gave authorization for that purpose, but it would provide some efficiency for individual Alaskans in control of their health data. So those are the critical, elements, and otherwise the language is largely to clean up and make sure that it's clear who's doing what and what are the allowable uses are of the health information exchange data that comes from it.
Thank you. So do you have a question, mm-hmm. Senator Myers?
Yeah, I do, but I can wait. It's up to you.
Well, my first question is, I think the perception among a lot of members of the public is that last thing you described, an individual asking saying, please send my data to this place. I think most Alaskans think we can already do that, and that's sort of what the purpose is. So is that not the case, or how does this change existing law?
The way the statute is currently written is that the data that is in the HIE is to be used for treatment, payment, and limited operations. And so something that falls outside of that, for example, if I wanted to apply for some sort of a state or federal benefit that needed documentation that I had a certain health condition, we could not clearly have a way to use the data from the HIE to allow that to be sent for that documentation. They would have to go to those source providers, which in some cases is multiple providers when you talk about more complex conditions. So at this point, so this would clearly allow in statute, so there's no confusion that an individual Alaskan could give specific authorization for that to happen. That would not happen. This language does not allow that to happen without the express permission of the person. Everything that falls under HIPAA would still fall under HIPAA, and the HIE, that type of data sharing would not change, but this would just allow Alaskans to have more control over their health data that exists in a nice consolidated format in the HIE.
Very good. Senator Myers, your question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the designated entity here in question, I was wondering if you could just give some examples of what entities exist in the state that might qualify for that?
So how the statute is written, any entity, for-profit or not-profit, could as long as they could meet all these standards, could serve in that capacity. So don't know that I'm in a good place to call out a specific example of someone who could qualify, but any healthcare organization, any private vendor, any vendor that you might think of that has other health data within it, if they could meet all of these standards, theoretically could serve as that. So it really could be any for-profit or nonprofit vendor or healthcare organization who could make all of it happen in the legal bounds that are in the statute.
Okay. And then just
go ahead.
Yeah, just a little bit different line. any change? You were talking about HIPAA a little bit.
Yeah.
Is this going to cause any changes between, say, minors versus adults? Or is that all going to stay the same?
Nope. Absolutely. It would all stay the same. And so this doesn't expand or contract anything that is currently a HIPAA standard or really even in the current HIE statute in that regard that falls in that HIPAA data exchange allowable uses. Just provides clarity around it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Giesel?
Yeah, so talk about interoperability of the various systems that providers have. How does that work?
Yeah, so when we talk about interoperability, just for people who are more or less familiar about that, it's really how those different health record systems interplay. So there's some very large systems. Things like Epic and Cerner are very large vendors for EMRs. There's also many smaller EMR vendors. Some of those connect well together, some of them don't. And I would say in general, no, not surprisingly, larger systems like that connect better. They're more robust. They're also extremely, extremely expensive, which means there are only certain health organizations who would really be able to utilize those systems. So when we think about healthcare in Alaska, and the presentations earlier really underscore the small, the rural organizations who are looking to connect health records, their health record systems typically need a little bit more work to connect them, and they're usually not on the same systems as the larger organizations because that's a different price point. So what the Health Information Exchange really has the ability to do is connect to each of those systems to bring those data into a centralized place so organizations can access that central repository for, again, allowable uses and the data that's appropriate to have in that repository. So it helps with the interoperability in that there can be a centralized place so one small healthcare organization doesn't have to look at a data connection to multiple other entities. They can make one data connection because every one of those data connections has dollars associated with it. So one data connection to the HIE, and that's where really the efficiency and the interoperability support comes with the HIE.
Thank you, Mr. Shim.
Thank you. Any follow-up? Okay. I have a question. So we are on this committee. We've been discussing the impacts of HR 1, the federal level, with rural health transformation, but also with things like the new Medicaid requirements. Some of those are medical exemptions. I'm wondering, can folks access the data you have, or will they be able to prove up some of those exemptions?
So I think we're working right now with the department on what that could or might look like. I think the HIE is a good place to be looking when it is a medical exemption. We do come into, and this is where some of the statutory looking at making sure that we're within allowable uses in terms of qualifications for services. So what kinds of things, Medicaid is a payer of services, so they have HIPAA-protected access to certain data as a payer. With that said, if someone's applying for Medicaid services and they're not a Medicaid beneficiary or they're looking at that, that would kind of fall in that bucket of needing to have the patient want to have their data used in that way. So I think working through some of the allowability and what would need to be what Medicaid has legal authority under HIPAA to access already, and what would need a patient-directed authorization to access that data. But I think the key piece is that the HIE has a lot of data in one place, so looking how to make that efficient for Alaskans is really critical. And for the new requirements under HR 1, that of course anyone who has an exemption would like to be able to get them moving through quickly so nobody's reviewing through applications that don't need to be reviewed in that same way. So I think that was probably not a very concise answer, but I think the HIE, the data, there's good data there that would help support some of those exemptions and then really ensuring that we have a clear pathway on what that looks like.
Very good. We have a question from Senator Kiesel and then Senator Meyer.
So tell me how it operates right now. So let's say that I have a small provider in a small clinic, right? And I have an MRI at Imaging Associates. Does that provider have the ability to go directly to Imaging Associates to receive the report of the radiologic assessment, or do they go through you?
They always can go directly to whoever provided it. That would be an option. I mean, if they wanted to. I mean, they could work out that connection. The value of the HIE would be if the organization who provided that imaging was connected to the HIE, so their radiology reports came into the HIE, then when you are seen, no matter who, so say that imaging organization sends data to the HIE, all of their records, those reports come in. So then no matter if what primary care practice someone sees, those primary care practices could access the record from there, and that imaging provider would only have to have one data connection to the HIE rather than having a data connection to each of the places or running around with CDs to provide the image results or faxing reports.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was the HIE affected by the 2022 Department of Health data breach?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good to hear. Good question. Good to hear. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may seem like a sophomoric question, but how does Indian Health Services work with the HIE? And does this mean that Alaskan's data becomes nationalized, as I know Indian Health Service has their own exchange?
Yeah. Great question. So, and I will say we've worked directly with the Alaska Tribal Health Partners more than Indian Health Service per se at the national level. So we have on our board, we have a seat for a Tribal Health Partner. We also have a federal seat, and Tribal Health is one possible entity. So currently ANTHC has the seat for the Tribal Health Partners, and our federal health partner is actually also a Tribal Health representative, so which has been great for that. We have been working really closely with a couple of Tribal Health Partners in particular. So ANTHC actually just has finalized an agreement with Healthy Connect for that connection. So that will be really helpful in sharing those data. We have also worked with Search, is now connected to the HIE, as those tribal health organizations, some are on a shared electronic system and some are on different electronic systems. So it's helping with that. It's also helping with individuals who get care inside and outside of the tribal health system, which is not uncommon. They may go somewhere else for specialty care. So then the records can come in and be in one spot. So we've been working really closely with ANTHC in particular, as we really work through some of those data sharing issues and make sure that it feels like the right path and the right data sharing on each end. Each organization that is a healthcare organization that is a participant with the HIE also has the opportunity to decide what data they send to the HIE. So it's not an all or none situation, and that sometimes can be different based on the particular organization. So we just work with them individually on that, what's appropriate for them.
Very good. Any other questions? All right. Thank you. Ms. Stickett, do you have any closing remarks before we set the bill aside?
No, just appreciate the time and the consideration, and really appreciate the support this committee has already given to the HIE. I think we're really seeing some of the impact and the utilization of the HIE for that core infrastructure for the state. And as we look at the Rural Health Transformation Program and those sorts of things, I think having this infrastructure and having it really be part of the core healthcare infrastructure of Alaska really puts us in a position to be able to leverage some of those funds and opportunities for transformative systems in Alaska. So thank you for the time.
Thank you. And I'll say I think you did a good job introducing the remainder of the bill. So rather than call Ms. Harbison up, I'm going to ask my colleagues to read the remainder of the sectional on their own time. We're going to set this bill aside. We'll bring it back up at a later date.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sticka. The next meeting, any closing remarks before I close? All right. The next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be held on Thursday, March 12th. We'll have a presentation from the National Conference of State Legislatures on the Rural Health Transformation Program, A National Perspective. This will be a joint hearing with the House Health and Social Services Committee and thus take place in Davis 106. Thank you, everyone, for a very productive hearing. This committee is adjourned at 4:44 p.m.